First of all, pronunciation of your name. How do you prefer it? Olin or...
It's actually pronounced Olin.
Is that French?
It's Swedish.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
How did Swedes get to Canada?
My father is Swedish. He grew up in Stockholm, and he became a professor, and he got a job teaching English at McGill University in Montreal. So that's how I came to grow up in Canada.
What was it like growing up in Canada?
It was very interesting. It's a very cosmopolitan environment in Montreal. There's, of course, the two languages. So I grew up in an atmosphere in which you would hear more than one language regularly, and then also a lot of European and other immigrants in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up in Montreal. So a lot of diversity and a lot of kind of artistic and intellectual life.
Two languages, Swedish and English.
Right? Well, those two languages, yes, but also French and English in Montreal.
Your household, your father was a professor at McGill, so did you have a bookish childhood?
Yes, very much so. My father was a professor, and my mother had been trained to be a public school teacher before becoming a full-time wife and mother, and so it was a household in which books and reading were very much valued, and authors were discussed, and the walls of the houses were lined with books, and you could just sort of pick and choose and browse, you know, as you went along, and that's something that I spent a lot of my time doing as a child.
Siblings?
Yes, I grew up with three siblings. I have two brothers and a sister, and we all became sort of writer-editor type people. My older brother is an editor at Oxford University Press, my sister is a journalist, and my younger brother is a professor at the law school at Cornell, so... I think those early years of books and reading and writing definitely were a formative influence on all of us.
What sort of books did you read, and what authors did you read as a child that might have influenced you?
Well, I read very indiscriminately. Some of it was appropriate for my age, and some of it wasn't. I definitely read a lot as a young child of books in which young women writers were portrayed as imaginative and sort of heroic in a way. Books like Anne of Green Gables and Little Women had, you know, figures of the young female writer that were certainly influential on me. But I also read a lot of stuff that I read quite young, before I probably should have, but that I really loved. And there were books that my father had because of his interest in American literature. So I read very young books by Salinger and Updike and Fitzgerald and Hemingway, and a lot of short stories by those authors that I really loved. And I think those influenced me a lot as well in terms of eventually becoming a short story writer myself.
What was the spark that led to this literary career of yours? I mean, you could have gone into dietetics, you could have been a dental hygienist, a lot of other fields that most people would have probably adopted rather than the literary life.
That's true. My mother is always bemoaning the fact that none of us saw fit to become doctors or lawyers or something more practical. But I honestly think that I never really wanted to be anything else. I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a young child, and I wrote a lot on my own for fun. It was what I did for, you know, solace or companionship, or not that I was an unhappy child at all. It was just, you know, living in the world of books was very much my home from the time that I was very young. So although I considered other fields that would be more practical, they were always something related to literature. I thought about publishing or becoming a kind of professor of literature as opposed to a creative writer, but I never really strayed far afield from books because that's what felt like home to me.
Did you ever feel separated from your peers?
A little bit, and not enormously, but I would say that, you know, at an age when other kids were more interested in, I don't know, physical activities or something, I always really liked to be at home and reading. But, you know, I did all those other things too, so it's not like I was I was really, really separated. I just always really enjoyed, in addition to spending time with other people, really enjoyed that time by myself, or didn't feel like time by myself because it felt like time spent with friends, right, with characters that seemed real to me. So it was another dimension to my social life rather than an escape from the real social world.
Well, you must have had a powerful academic life. Mm-hmm. You were accepted at Harvard, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that your first tour of the United States when you went off to college in Cambridge?
No, it wasn't. My mother is actually American, and so we had grown up spending a lot of vacation time in the U.S. We would go to Maine quite often in the summers, and then we would also occasionally drive all the way across the United States to New Mexico, which is where my mother's parents were, and we would spend sometimes the entire summer there in the desert in New Mexico and then return to Canada at the end of the summer. So I had spent a certain amount of time in the States before I got to Harvard, and I am a dual citizen, and so I had a kind of sense of familiarity with it, although I had never lived there full time.
How does one become a dual citizen? By simply because one parent is
American? My mother had arranged for us to be registered as American citizens as soon as we were born, and then because I was born in Canada, I had the Canadian citizenship as well. So I grew up with that dual identity from the start.
What was Harvard like?
I loved it there. I was thrilled to be there. I thought it was a beautiful atmosphere physically. It was incredibly exciting intellectually. It was one of the happiest periods of my life. Even though it was challenging academically, it was really rewarding. And it was also rewarding socially. I really made wonderful friends there who are still my closest friends. And I just had a great time. I really enjoyed every single minute of it.
What did you study?
I studied English literature, and then I sort of indulged various side interests that I had in art history and film, but I really struggled with any of the other kind of non-arts or humanities requirements in the common course of study, things like science or math. That was really a struggle for me, but in English courses or in courses about art or film, I felt like I was up to the task of being a Harvard student, and I really loved it. And I also did a lot of extracurricular activities. I wrote for the newspaper. I was involved in kind of women's rights groups. So it was a very busy, very happy time in my life.
What happened after graduation?
After graduation, I moved to New York, and I worked actually in book publishing for a couple of years. I was an intern at Random House, which was an incredibly helpful experience for a writer in that I was paid to rotate around all the various departments of the publishing company. So I spent time in editorial, but I also spent time in foreign rights, in marketing, in contracts. I went out with the salespeople to see how they sold the books from the catalog to the bookstores. It was an incredibly wonderful program that I think, unfortunately, now has been discontinued. But it really taught me a lot about the whole business of publishing from, you know, top to bottom, as it were. And that really came in handy later when it was time to write my own books. And it was also really a helpful time because I met a young woman at that time who was working at Doubleday, and she was an editorial assistant at Doubleday, and we got to be very close friends. We spent a lot of time together, and we had sort of comparable positions and aspirations, and she was just a great person. And later on, after I left publishing and left New York, years passed, and I, you know, became a writer and wanted to submit my work. And in the meantime, she had left Doubleday and become a book agent. And so she, my very good friend, became my literary agent, which she is to this day. And I was just so fortunate to have this connection with her that has been a wonderful friendship, but also a really wonderful literary partnership as well.
What is her name?
Her name is Amy Williams, and she now is a partner at her own agency, which is called McCormick Williams in New York.
Why do I have this feeling that going into publishing is like the kiss of death in becoming a writer? Didn't happen to you.
It didn't happen to me, and there's a, you know, well-worn path of writers before me who did it. People like Toni Morrison, you know, worked in publishing for a long time, and James Wilcox as well, who's a Southern writer that I admire. So I knew that other people had done it. That said, you are right that it can be damaging or difficult for a writer. I myself felt like I could not sustain it while also doing my own work, partly because a huge part of my job was to reject other writers and to see just these huge stacks of manuscripts coming in from aspiring writers and to see them kind of go out the door. And it was very difficult to imagine becoming the person who was successful in making it to the top of one of those stacks. And then I also spent, you know, a lot of my time reading manuscripts, and then to come home at the end of the day and write my own was feeling hard, was feeling difficult. And in the end, I decided that I didn't think that I could do both. And I wound up, after a couple of years, quitting that job and leaving New York as well.
Did you ever work in a bookstore?
I did. That was the next thing that I did. After I left publishing, I moved to New Mexico, and started writing very intensively on my own. And the job that I took to support myself was at a Barnes and Noble bookstore, and I worked there for a couple of years. And that also taught me a lot about the book industry. And it was a good experience, although not maybe the best job ever. But it was good. I enjoyed it.
When you were in New York, no doubt that you went to the Strand bookstore, which is one of the largest secondhand bookstores in the United States. I used to haunt the Strand, but it was such a depressing place. The employees at the Strand bookstore had a union. They were surly and nasty, and they had lovely books, inexpensive books. And every Saturday I would go poking around the Strand. But I began to feel some empathy toward the employees there because it was such a discouraging place to work. It was hot, it was not air conditioned, it was dirty, crowded, it was unpleasant. And I began to wonder about the quality of life for people going into book sales.
Yeah. Well, people who work in bookstores are really the unsung heroes of every writer's life. I mean, they're just what they do is so important. And in independent bookstores, the way they can communicate with customers and talk about, you know, what books they're reading, I mean, they just have a major influence on, you know, the kind of chain of communication between a writer and his or her audience. But the Strand, it's not an exaggeration to say the Strand really kept me alive during the years that I lived in New York, because I made a very little money when I worked at Random House. And at a certain point, my boss said, "Let me tell you a secret. I used to be an assistant just like you. And you know all those extra review copies that get sent to us that we don't have anything to do with? You can take them to the Strand, and all you have to say is, 'Books to go down,' and they will give you money." And I didn't really even understand what he was talking about. It was like some magical password. But I took this bag of extra books that had been sent to us that, you know, nobody wanted, and I got to the Strand and I said, "Books to go down," and they took the bag away, and they came back and gave me like $100. And really, $100, you know, a month. I did it probably once a month. It really, I mean, that was how I bought my groceries for like 2 years. So I will be forever grateful to the Strand. They really did keep me in food.
Well, you're living in New Mexico now, and at some point, I guess you decided to go on to graduate school.
I did, yeah. I was living in New Mexico, and I was really trying to teach myself how to write. I would write every day, you know, in coffee shops and at home, and writing these short stories, and really felt kind of on my own. And I realized at a certain point, well, I'm not going to write overnight a brilliant novel or achieve my aspiration. Originally had been to become Alice Munro somehow and write these sort of fully formed short stories and never publish anywhere except The New Yorker. And after a few years, I started to think, well, maybe I need some kind of intermediate step before that, some sense of validation, so that I won't feel so kind of at sea in terms of whether or not I'm going to achieve any kind of success at this career of being a writer. So I decided to go to graduate school, and I went to the University of Texas at Austin to a program called the Michener Center, which was founded by Michener, Doylestown connection there. And he had donated a very generous sum of money to enable young writers to have time to write. And so there were these very, very generously endowed fellowships that were available enough to live on. And it was a 3-year program where the responsibilities were minimal. There were workshop classes and a few other classes, but your main charge as a student in the program was to devote yourself to writing. And that's what I did. And it was a very, very fruitful period for me. And I also made good friends there who were my peers and excellent writers. And that was when I started to publish short stories and start to feel like, okay, you know, this is something that I can actually do.
Is that where you began your first novel?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I began the novel. It was my thesis project. So in the third year, I was to complete a thesis for my MFA, and I decided that it would be a good time to try to write a novel because it would give me a deadline and some structure, and I would just write, you know, a first draft of the novel. So I began it in, or began thinking of it in my second year and kind of outlining and doing some research, and then I wrote the first draft over the 9 months of that academic year before I graduated. And it was a pretty messy draft and pretty embryonic, but the experience of writing something from the beginning to the end gave me the confidence that I could then take that kind of lump of clay and mold it into a more complete book.
Well, as we speak now, it's June 2009, and this is the month of the New Yorker's double summer fiction issue. And there's an interesting article in that issue called "Can Creative Writing Be Taught?"
Mm-hmm.
You spent 3 years trying to learn the process of creative writing, so I guess let me put the question to you. Can it be taught? You can at least attend creative writing classes, but can you learn and can you teach it?
I absolutely do think that you can teach it. I don't think you can give someone talent if they don't have any, nor can you give them the energy or persistence that are required, nor can you give them vision or courage. Those are all separate ingredients, but there are specific skills that one can practice in just the same way that one can learn specific skills in the painting of watercolors or the playing of the piano, right? And if you really take a work of fiction apart, which, I mean, this is what I think is involved in the teaching of creative writing. You read the work of other writers that you admire and you say, okay, this is a truly compelling character. What are the particular things that the words on the page are doing that are successful, right? Break it apart into component pieces, right? That sense of characterization, and then imitate it. And the same thing would be true for a writer's particular use of dialogue or of setting. It has to do with being a more acute and self-conscious reader and then trying to achieve those same effects, or something radically different if that's what you want in your own work. So I think that there are limitations to what the teaching of writing can accomplish, but what it can accomplish is very real and very tangible.
But imitation is a factor in learning.
Absolutely.
So as you began to submit material to your classes, what was that process like? For example, did you have a creative writing professor who would look at it critically? It was a difficult process? Or were you getting encouragement or what?
It's a standard workshop format that I went through where you have a group of writers in the room and led by a professor, but it's really a communal discussion. And you take the draft apart and really sort of discuss it and look at it closely. And, you know, this is obviously the model that was pioneered, you know, at the University of Iowa back in the 40s and has proven to be a fairly successful one. It's not the only way to do it, but it is pretty helpful. I think for a lot of writers, you finish a draft and you really have no more distance from your work. You're so close to it, to the process, to the ideas and emotions that led you to it. It's very hard to take a step back and really look at it, look at the craft of it, look at it technically, and figure out what it's really about. So those other sets of eyes are really, really helpful to give you that clear-eyed view of your own work and help you push it to the next level. And it's true that writers didn't always have workshop leaders to give them criticism, but they've always had other readers, right? An editor who will come in and do that service for you, or an agent, or a peer, right? You read each other's work. So this is just a more kind of elaborated version of that, and it is enormously helpful, I think.
So you found 3 years in Austin helpful?
Yeah.
Even though Austin is in Texas.
Well, Austin is kind of Texas adjacent, shall we say. It's a very, very special place. It's, I think, not exactly like the rest of Texas. It has a very particular, very wonderful character to it. And I loved it there. It's really, the people there are very idiosyncratic. They're very kind of free-thinking and fun-loving. They love to play music, and there's a kind of residue of the hippie culture that still remains very strongly there. So I had a great time there, except for the weather, which I found was too hot for me, and I really missed the seasonality of the East Coast, and I found myself longing to be closer to home and to my family, and so I wound up moving away from Texas in the end.
University of Texas, they must have a tremendous endowment. Don't they have a research library there that is almost without peer?
The Ransom Center at the University of Texas has probably the best collection of writerly manuscripts and writers' letters in the country, and they have been extremely aggressive in collecting the work of a lot of writers. So they would have wonderful exhibits where you can go and see sort of books in process, through the manuscripts, and it's a wonderful archive and a wonderful resource for scholars and writers.
What happened after graduate school?
After graduate school, I wasn't quite sure what to do with myself. I knew I wanted to keep writing, and I didn't want to work full time because I wanted to try to continue to revise that novel that I had started. So I moved to the East Coast, and I spent a year in Massachusetts kind of working part time, and then I ultimately decided to go into teaching. And I got a wonderful teaching position in Rhode Island, where I was the writer in residence at a boarding school just north of Newport. And it was a great position because it involved teaching just one class and otherwise being available for students who were interested in creative writing. And it didn't pay much, but it came with free room and board. So it enabled me to have very little in the way of expenses, to live in a beautiful environment right on Narragansett Bay, and to finish my book that I had started. So it was a wonderful introduction to teaching, but it was also kind of like another fellowship in terms of giving me some more time to work on my book.
That's odd, isn't it? A boarding school having a writer in residence?
There's actually quite a few programs like that. Exeter has one, and there's one in Baltimore at the Tickner School. So it seems to be a kind of a growing trend among prep schools. They don't spend a lot of money because they already have the facilities to give you room and board. And in return, they get a kind of rotating member of the faculty who can help sort of give their students a little value-added experience in terms of the arts.
Well, at some point you moved up to the college level.
That's right. After 2 years at Portsmouth Abbey, I had my books under contract, and it was time for me to move on to the next level. So I went looking for a college level job, and I got my job at Lafayette and moved to Easton in the summer of 2004.
What's it like living in Easton and teaching at Lafayette?
I really, really enjoy it. I feel very fortunate to have landed there. Lafayette is small, and the students are very, very good. They're very smart and very dedicated, and I get to know them quite well, which I really like. The classes are fairly small, 15 students in my writing classes, and I often have the same student more than once, so I can kind of watch them develop as writers and help them with that over the course of their college education. So I think that I'm very fortunate to have landed there. And I really like the location of Easton. I like that it's a kind of smaller town where I can have a relatively quiet life, but it's close enough to New York and Philadelphia that I don't feel stranded, and I can go in and see my friends in those places. And so it's worked out quite well for me.
On the interstates as well, so you can go up and down the
exactly.
East Coast. What kind of workload do you have?
I teach five courses a year. So I generally teach two in the fall and three in the spring. And I teach courses in creative writing, And literature. I also teach courses in screenwriting and film. In my graduate program, we specialized in more than one genre. It's an interdisciplinary MFA program, so I specialized primarily in fiction with a secondary interest in screenwriting. So when I came to Lafayette, they knew that I had some expertise in screenwriting, and they were very excited about building their film offerings. So I've been teaching screenwriting and then some courses in the making and analysis of film since I arrived, and there's a lot of interest in the part of students, and those courses are very fun to teach. So,
how did you have a background in film to be able to teach it?
I was just sort of interested in it, so I had done that stuff as a graduate student and written some screenplays and taken some film classes, so it was based on that that I was able to do the teaching of it.
Every time I pick up the New Yorker, I see someone bewailing the quality of education today and the quality of people who go through the public school system. So I wonder, what kind of students do you have? Of course, these are dedicated students if they're going into creative writing, so possibly that sets them apart.
Yeah. They're dedicated students at a very well-endowed private college as well. So a lot of them come from either excellent public schools in kind of very good suburbs, or they come from private high schools. So they're probably not representative of the educational crisis in this country, which is very real and hugely important. So, you know, I never forget how lucky we are and they are at Lafayette to, you know, participate in the kind of education that they are receiving, because it's not true for the majority of students, you know, in this country. But these students tend to be very well prepared, very motivated. There are no discipline issues. They tend to have enormous kind of reserves of support from their families. So it's really a lucky few that we are up there.
Well, at some point while you're in Easton teaching, your books came up,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of odd. Most writers begin with a collection of short stories,
mm-hmm.
but you actually began with a novel. So tell me a little bit about how The Missing Person, your novel, came about.
Well, I had written that first draft of it in graduate school, and then I started working on a revision of it, and I had about 50 pages that were relatively polished of a later draft. In the meantime, I had also been writing and publishing short stories. I had published, I forget how many, but a few. And one of them won a prize from the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And I started to get a certain amount of interest from agents and editors. And so my friend and agent, Amy, and I started talking about what we wanted to do, you know, given this interest. And she said, well, why don't we send around, you know, a sample collection of your stories and this 50 pages of the novel, and try and get you a two-book contract. So we did that, and I had I wound up with two offers. One was from Simon & Schuster, and one was from Knopf, and I decided to go with Knopf. And the editor that I have there, Gary Fiskejohn, who's a wonderful editor and has shepherded a lot of incredible writers through their careers, people like Richard Ford and Tobias Wolff, and he's worked with Cormac McCarthy and Jay McInerney, a lot of wonderful writers. In any event, he had the idea that instead of publishing the collection first, that I should go back and finish the novel and put the novel out first. He felt that I would get more attention that way, that more people would read the novel and then be waiting for the stories, and that it would be different, you know, a different pattern from this usual thing of publishing like a junior collection and then graduating to the novel. And so he wanted to try it that way. And since I trust and respect him so much, I said, okay, I will do that. So I went back and worked on finishing the novel, and he helped me with it a lot. And then we published first the novel and then the collection of stories, which in the meantime I had written a bunch of new ones to go in the book as well. So I think it worked very well, and I liked that it didn't position the short story collection as this kind of intermediary step or juvenile step along the way to the novel. It really gave the stories a lot of credibility, and I did have a certain amount of recognition to my name based on the novel. So I think that he was right in flipping them.
It sounds like a workable strategy, all right. Most of The Missing Person takes place in Albuquerque, so I had wondered how someone from Canada via Texas, via Massachusetts would and Brooklyn would wind up in Albuquerque. Now I know because your grandparents live there, but I'm not familiar with Albuquerque, but I was taken aback by there was kind of a love-hate relationship with Albuquerque. It comes across as a very unpleasant place to live. At the same time, I think the narrator has a certain fondness for it. So tell me a little bit about why you decided to set the novel there and your own personal feelings toward Albuquerque.
I lived in Albuquerque for 4 years, and I loved it very, very much. And I really miss New Mexico and the desert. It's a very special place. And I had originally not conceived the book as taking place in Albuquerque. I had the characters in mind and the family dynamics. But then, as soon as I made the decision to set it there, Albuquerque really sort of took over the book, and it really very much became a book about New Mexico and the environment. And I felt that there was no way to write a book about New Mexico without addressing the very real problems that exist there in terms of the sprawl and the environmental consequences of this growing city in the desert. So I felt that I didn't want to write a book that romanticized New Mexico, which a lot of people I think have done. There's a sort of Hallmark version of what New Mexico is like that's very scenic, kind of great place to go on vacation, and nobody really talks about the kind of gritty reality of it, the poverty, not negative, but the other dimensions to life there that are very real. So that was part of what I wanted to get across as a non-romanticized vision of New Mexico. And then at the same time, I wanted to write this book in which the narrator had grown up there and left. And I think the love-hate relationship that you describe very much comes out of my attempt to portray the psychology of this character who does very much love and miss her home, but at the same time really wanted to escape it. And in the book, it's very much connected to her ambivalent feelings towards her family and some stuff that they have gone through. So her relationship with Albuquerque is complicated because it's her home and because it's connected to her family. So that kind of back and forth relationship is very much at the heart of the book.
It starts off as a kind of a detective mystery in a way, because the narrator goes to Albuquerque to seek out her missing brother. So, do you have any influences with regard to mystery or detective fiction?
I'm a big fan of mystery and detective fiction. I am a huge fan of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Dorothy L. Sayers. I love those kinds of books. I don't exactly have the mindset to write them, and the best that I could do was to kind of gesture in the direction of them. And I am also a fan of a lot of books that are sort of literary novels that gesture in the direction of the detective novel, but then wind up to be less about the plot and more about the characters. So books like Dennis Johnson's Resuscitation of a Hangman or Kazuo Ishiguro's When We Were Orphans, these were books that I had read that have detective-like figures in them, and a kind of active plot, but the themes and the psychology are really more important than the plot lines kind of unraveling in any kind of straightforwardly mechanical way. So that was the kind of book that I was trying to write, is one that had this certain kind of nuance or tone of the detective, but the real mystery, as I thought of it in my mind, is the mystery of the family, not the mystery of the plot.
What are you working on now? If you have this workload at Lafayette, do you have how much time do you have for your own writing?
Right. Well, I was very fortunate to have it's called a junior leave. Last year, I had the year off from teaching, and I was able to make quite a bit of progress on a new novel, which I have now in embryonic form, and I'm trying over the course of this summer to revise it and polish it and get it into better shape, hopefully by the fall.
Do you have summer work, or can you
No,
devote the summer to your own
I'm
work?
just working on writing. So that's very helpful to have that big chunk of time.
Publishing, it seems to be in such flux today. You wonder where it's going. Should people self-publish? Should people do e-books? What the hell is going on in the publishing industry?
Yeah, the publishing industry is certainly in crisis, and I suppose the only comfort is that it's not the only industry that's in crisis. Every industry is, and especially all of the entertainment industries. You know, the film industry is in crisis, and so is the music industry. The advent of these technologies has changed things permanently, and I don't think that anyone, certainly not I, knows what the future holds for book publishing. I don't think it'll ever go back to being the way that it was with the paper hardcover book as the primary medium of literature. That doesn't mean it's going to vanish completely, but there is going to have to be more room made for the use of devices like the Kindle and exciting opportunities like web publishing. So I don't really know. I leave it to others to figure out how to sort of make all this make all this happen and make it, you know, at least a little bit profitable so that people like editors and agents have an incentive to stay involved. I mean, I don't really believe in a 100% self-published universe just because, sure, you can do that, but if every single person who wanted to write a book self-published, then it'd be very hard for the reader to find the books that they want to read and that are of good quality. I mean, there's a reason that all that apparatus exists, right, of book publishing companies, of reviews, of magazines, right? It's to create a context in which writing can be evaluated and improved. So I have no idea what's going to happen is the short answer, but I only hope that people will continue reading in some medium, in some format, so that I can continue to write.
Well, I assume that the creative writing impulse is so ingrained in some people that they are going to find an outlet for their writing in any event.
Right.
But how it must be very discouraging for young writers today when they see the difficulties of getting published.
Right.
It's probably always been difficult getting published, but the traditional ways of being published have changed.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice do you have to your own students about it?
I try not to focus too much on the publishing aspect of things with my students who are very young. They're mostly 18 to 22 years old. And I think that if you go into it, you know, thinking, well, how am I going to make my career or my profession in writing? You'll just wind up full of anxiety and self-doubt, even more than you already are. I think that if you want to write, you really have to be in it for the love of it. It has to be pure, not just because you'll produce better work, but because it will help you navigate the inevitable difficulties and disappointments of trying to get your work out there. If you don't do it for the right reasons, which is to say, because you have to do it, then you're going to wind up in trouble. So I really just try and focus on, well, what do you love? What do you love to read? And what do you love to write? And let's try and make that the best it can possibly be.
For your students, do you recommend any writers working today that they might use as role models or find helpful? People, writers that you personally like?
Well, in terms of recommendations, I really just try to expose the students to as broad an array of writers as I can. So I use a lot of short story anthologies, which contain a lot of different styles of writing, a lot of different approaches to what a story can be, to what fiction writing can be, because different things will strike a chord with different students, and you never know in advance. But there are so many wonderful writers working today that do appeal to the students, people like George Saunders and Laurie Moore, Mary Gateskill, Jonathan Latham. These are all wonderful writers that the students tend to respond to and that I, you know, very eagerly await books from. So in spite of all the problems in the crisis, I do think it's an exciting time for writing. It's an exciting time for the American short story. So much good work is being done. It's hard for me to get too depressed about it.
Well, Alex, Olin, just to kind of wrap things up, you're going to hate me for asking this question, but do you have any creative writing advice that you could give to fledgling writers to help them on their path to becoming a full-fledged writer?
I think there are really only two things that people must do. One is you have to read. You cannot be a writer if you don't read. And it never ceases to amaze me how many people say, well, I would like to write, but I'm not really much of a reader. It just doesn't work that way. You have to really be able to immerse yourself in a text and feel what it's doing, feel the excitement of it. You have to just read as much and as widely as you can. The second thing is that you really have to write. It can't just stay in your mind as an idea until it's perfect and then you just set it down. You have to be willing to write, be willing to write badly at first. The only way to get to the stuff that's better is to give yourself the permission to write the stuff that is flawed and then try to improve as you go along.
Sounds like good advice to me. Alex Orlean, thank you very much.
Thank you.